Welcome on the show, Jason.
Hi, Miles.
Now, indeed, I wish it was a more cheery topic, but for some of our listeners who may not know, there are 135 ethnic groups that have been recognised in Myanmar. So why is it that the Rohingya people are experiencing such a heightened level of persecution?
Well, Miles, I think, the Rohingya are obviously a Muslim group in a country which is predominantly Buddhist. And there's a lot of nationalist identity which exists in Myanmar, and a lot of propaganda as well. And myself and some co-authors read an article the other day that really was encouraging people to broaden their analysis of this situation and be a bit more responsible rather than looking at these very partisan views which are coming out, just to widen the scope of discourse.
Indeed. And let's touch on, so what are the other factors within Myanmar that have led to this forced displacement of the Rohingya, which have not been documented and addressed, that you want to kind of raise, that you've raised in this article?
Yeah, so most of the issues that are coming out are kind of leading to generalizing claims, for example, that all the Rohingya are terrorists from one side, or that all Buddhist Burmese support genocide on the other side. And really, this is the worst kind of propaganda. So our article really tried to focus on some of the economic and political agendas which are simmering under the surface. And our argument was that the religious violence which is happening, and the military ethnic cleansing, which is certainly happening, is actually just a result of these political and economic forces.
And so how has development in Myanmar, particularly across its rural areas, led to the displacement of the Rohingyas?
So displacement in Myanmar isn't a new phenomenon. It's been going on for decades, land grabbing and confiscation of land. Previous to the democratic transition, actually a lot of the land grabbing was not involving Rakhine province or the Rohingya. It was actually involving a lot of other ethnic groups. And what we saw in 2016 was that the government designated 3 million acres in Rakhine province for economic development. And you have to wonder about the link between that and the current violence.
Okay, so there are a few issues that have kind of been perhaps murmuring under the surface that haven't been explored as much. Why do you think they've been overlooked?
Well, I think a lot of the media coverage of this has focused on Aung San Suu Kyi, who was obviously in the spotlight for a long time as a kind of human rights leader and a democratic icon. And the Western media is obviously a bit fascinated by her so-called fall from grace, or the turning from a Peace Prize winner into she's been characterized as a monster now. So there's very little nuance in the analysis in the mainstream media. And I think usually it's uncomfortable to talk about these issues of economic and political power struggles. But that's, in my opinion, certainly what is causing the current violence.
And that's an interesting thing because, and I must admit, though I don't know a lot about the politics of Myanmar, I remember hearing when Aung San Suu Kyi won election that there really was hope and that there'd be a lot of change in Myanmar and that things would become a lot better because she had been democratically elected. This kind of, as you said, it's lacking nuances. This idea that it's just a crass kind of fall from grace. But what is it? Because there is some disappointment in the air, I think, of what people may have hoped for with the election of Aung San Suu Kyi and what the realities have been. Is it the issues surrounding the military influence within parliament and indeed the whole operation of the nation?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a bit unclear the extent to which Aung San Suu Kyi actually has power over the military or is directing the current cleansing operations. So I think we need to consider that the military really hasn't lost a lot of power in the transition. And also we need to think about the struggle between corporate agendas as well in the country. You have this a big US-China kind of fight for resources in Myanmar, which isn't really talked about very much.
Well, let's talk about that now. There are countries and corporations within Asia that have those vested interests you're speaking of, particularly due to its natural resources. How has it exacerbated the plight of the Rohingya and other ethnic groups in Myanmar?
Well, I think under the military junta in Myanmar, you saw Chinese companies which were able to exploit the resources of Myanmar, for example, timber, the rivers, the minerals, particularly in the north. And there's been a history of armed conflicts between between the military regime and different groups, usually originating from different ethnic minorities.
Now, you're listening to the Monday Daily on 2SER 107.3. My guest is Jason von Medling, the HDR Director and Senior Lecturer in Disaster Risk Reduction from the School of Architecture and Built Environment at the University of Newcastle. I suppose, Jason, how can the rights of Rohingya be protected, given that they are in this highly vulnerable position as a result of their oppression and their loss of property and land? What are the solutions here?
Well, I think certainly what we're hoping to do is to shift this discourse to something which is much more focused on root causes of the conflict, rather than scratching the surface and characterizing the violence as a religious issue. Obviously, that is a factor. So I think part of it is shifting the discourse, but also I think that you know, the ASEAN region has to be much more responsible in the way that it deals with this crisis. And there needs to be pressure put on the government of Myanmar to be much more fair, much less focused on appealing to nationalist sentiment through propaganda. So I think from all sides, we need to see governments step back from the propaganda, step back from their corporate agendas, and actually focus on the people who are being harmed by this conflict, which is generally the most vulnerable and marginalized people. And we see this around the world. It's not a new thing.
Now, I just want to stay to Myanmar in this instance, particularly about the Australian government's dealings with Myanmar. We give quite a substantial amount to the Myanmar government in aid. We also used to give a lot of money to Fiji. Now, when there were issues around democratic rights and freedoms there, there was actually a big move from the Australian government to change the way in which foreign aid funding was given to Fiji and in the nature of the diplomatic relationships. It was, I suppose it's not dissimilar to imposing some sanctions on a country about saying, well, if you are doing X, Y, or Z, and they or whether you're guilty of human rights abuses or something like that, we're gonna change the manner in which you deal with this country. Would you like to see the Australian government do something along those lines with the Myanmar government?
Well, I would say that a lot of the time sanctions and restrictions on foreign aid are imposed to the advantage of the country that is taking that action. And very, very often it's under the guise of protecting freedoms or protecting rights. So if we're talking about serious diplomatic actions, which are forcing a government to change their practice, I'm certainly in favor, but I tend to be skeptical about the agenda, certainly when you're talking about Western nations which are still acting in this kind of neo-colonialist manner. You have the U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley, who's coming out condemning Aung San Suu Kyi and the Myanmar government, but honestly, I'm very skeptical about the agenda of the U.S. in this whole crisis.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining the program.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.